Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I'm happy to welcome Sarah Posner, author, journalist. You are the author of the recent book that's just come out, Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. So thank you, Sarah, for dropping into Mindshift Podcast.
Happy to do it, Clint.
I have so many questions. I was just saying, before we hit record, I've just finished listening to your book on Audible. I listened to it on the way back and forth to work. I have about an hour's drive, which is really handy for getting a good long section of books on Audible. So you've been researching, you've been writing about evangelicalism, televangelists. This is not your first book, obviously, prosperity gospel, but maybe most importantly, the connections to all that to the Christian right. What led you into that field? What led you to start researching and writing about this?
Well, it dates back to my time in college in the mid-1980s when Reagan was president. And I wrote my senior thesis about the political operatives and religious operatives in Washington who were putting together what was then known as the New Right and the Religious Right. Mm-hmm. And then after college, I ended up going to law school and practicing law for 10 years, but then decided to leave law and become a journalist. And I kind of picked up where I had left off in a way, because by that time, George W. Bush was president. And of course, he relied quite a bit also on his relationship with the Christian right, although much differently than Trump has been doing, but we can get into that.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. It's fascinating, I think, because I did a class a few months ago, an online course where I did a 5-week session. You can really trace the rise and the origins of the Christian right president to president, starting, I think, with Jimmy Carter, as you say, and then going into Reagan. And every president that's come along has either been an enemy of the Christian right or a friend of the Christian right in some way. So it's a fascinating study. So you started with Reagan. It truly is a fascinating thing. You go down the rabbit hole, don't you? And then you wonder where you come up for air.
Well, I think that a lot of people think that the founding of the moral majority and the modern Christian right in the late 1970s was some sort of beginning. Mm. And in a lot of ways it was. It marked the beginning of their organized involvement in national electoral politics. But the Christian right has always been here. It's just manifested itself in different ways. And finally, at that time, came together with these conservative political organizers to become kind of more attached to the hip with the Republican Party. Mm. But it's not like it came out of nowhere in terms of there being evangelicals and fundamentalists who were interested in political issues and animated by them.
Mm-hmm. So as I say, I've been working through Unholy. I just finished it yesterday on Audible on the way home. What I was struck by was sort of, this is my theory, that your thesis is sort of that there's a marriage between the Christian right and the alt-right. That's the new piece that I guess I wasn't ready for. I was expecting, to be honest, given the title, that it was going to be kind of another book about the white evangelical support for Trump, which it does certainly get into that, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I was not prepared for the whole alt-right piece that I can understand their support for Trump, but I'm seeing this marriage between the Christian right and the alt-right. Is that a fair assessment, do you think, of kind of your thesis statement of the book?
Yes. I don't know if marriage is the right word, because marriage, I would call it more of an arranged marriage.
Right.
Because marriage implies that both parties came into this together on purpose. And I think in some ways that's true, but I think also in other ways, circumstances played out in a particular way in the 2016 primary that led to it. Obviously, there were some people who were very explicitly interested in creating that kind of marriage. Steve Bannon is one of them. Mm. He told me in an interview that the alt-right could not win or could not beat back the progressive left, as he called it, without the Christian right. It needed the Christian right. But at the same time, the Christian right, as demonstrated by their unyielding support for Trump, are okay with being in coalition with the alt-right, right? So like none of the white supremacist, racist, nativist things that Trump has done or said, or personnel that he's appointed and placed in top positions in his administration, none of that has been enough for the Christian right to turn away from him. So while I don't think that a lot of the leadership of the Christian right intended for this to happen, if you dial the clock back to late 2015 during the primary, but I do think that they've proven themselves to be okay with it. And the middle section of the book, where I detail the racist history of the Christian right and also the racist history of the new right, this new conservative movement of the 1970s that gave us the modern religious right. There's more of a history there with regard to issues of race and immigration and civil rights that makes that marriage, as you put it, make more sense.
Mm-hmm. I was just reading an article today by Randall Balmer, who I think he's a Christian historian, but he's done a lot of, obviously, done a lot of work on the origins of the Christian right. And it was a really helpful article talking about, yes, they have this narrative that it was abortion, 1973, Roe versus Wade. Even Jerry Falwell Sr. mentioned that in some of his writings. I was instantly galvanized as soon as I heard the reports in 1973.
Right.
No, it goes back to 1954, the Brown versus Board of Education, the Segregation Academy. So actually that marriage, if we want to call it that, between the Christian right and the alt-right, the seeds were sown in racism going back to the 50s. It sounds like that's what you're saying in the book as well.
Right. So Randy has been reporting that very crucial bit of history for quite some time. And, you know, I've talked with him about it and read his articles as well. And in the book, I wanted to go and dig a little deeper into that to add some more color and detail to how evangelicals and fundamentalists decided to jump into this political fray because of school desegregation. And what Randy's reported is how Paul Weyrich, who was one of the architects of the new right and then of the religious right, and who was a very right-wing Catholic and very opposed to abortion, he had been trying to get evangelicals into coalition with him and his new right organizations over the abortion issue. And he just couldn't get them engaged, but it was this issue surrounding schools that did get them engaged. And so, as I said, Randy has talked about that, about his conversations with Weyrich back when Weyrich was alive, about that. And I decided to dig a little deeper into all of that. And I focus a lot in the middle section of the book on Reverend Bob Billings, who was one of the main organizers and promoters of K through 12 Christian schools, and who was opposed to government efforts to ensure that they did not have racially discriminatory policy, admissions policies. And it was actually Billings who was very close with Weyrich and who introduced Weyrich to Jerry Falwell. And Billings was the first executive director of the Moral Majority. And in my historical research for the book, it seemed to me that, you know, Weyrich had a lot more affection for Billings than he did even for Falwell, which was really interesting.
It really is interesting. I read an article today on NPR, and they were interviewing Paul Weyrich back in 1995. Terry Gross did an interview, and there's an excerpt from it online. It was really fascinating because he said that what he felt like the Moral Majority, where they failed, was they were kind of like a monarchist sort of approach. Their attitude was, well, let's just get one Christian president elected, and then we can go home, and that'll be us done, and we've won. And what Weyrich said is, no. You have to think strategically. You have to think long-term. That's the difference with guys like Weyrich, wasn't it, where he was thinking, in a way, generationally, I suppose, we have to have operatives. We have to go grassroots level all the way up to the very top in terms of political involvement. So he was very smart in that sense, I think.
I think that's right. And I also think that over time, the Christian right became more like that. Yeah. I would say that today's Christian right definitely is looking beyond one election cycle. And I think that that's a big part of the reason for their successes because they never rest, right? So even when they win, at, you know, whether it's Reagan, Bush, or Trump, they're still acting like they're at a disadvantage or they're at the brink of losing Christian America. And that's how they keep activists and, you know, basically the foot soldier, the grassroots activists or the foot soldiers of the movement engaged continually in the up times and in the downtime.
Yeah. That to me strikes as the Dominionist piece of it. When I read those kind of things and hearing you talk about that, when I read that article by Paul Weyrich today, I thought, he's speaking the language of Dominionism. He's speaking the language of guys like Rush Dooney in that sense that Rush Dooney was about generations, wasn't he? He was a long-term thinker way back in the 50s even. He was talking about we have to raise up generations. We have to train them and teach them and release them into society. And eventually we'll have an impact. It may take 1,000 years or whatever. But I think, okay, that's the language. And I know Rush Dooney and Weyrich were associates. They were helping each other around the time of the formation of the Moral Majority. So, and I know Rush Dooney served on the Council for National Policy for a little while. So he was involved on some levels. You know, you did mention Rush Dooney a little bit in the book. And I thought, oh, here we go. You're going to get into Rush Dooney. But a lot of it was about Weyrich, I think, in that section on the architecture of the Christian right.
That's right. Yes. And I think that, you know, there are sort of very important figures and players whose ideas had a lot of influence. And there's certainly been a lot written about Rush Dooney's influence that I didn't feel the need to like flesh that out as much in that section of the book, but just in fact, talk about how Rush Dooney was involved in these circles that Weyrich was establishing back in the 70s and 80s. Weyrich was responsible for forming a lot of organizations that now are the infrastructure, the architecture of the modern conservative movement. But yes, I mean, I think today a lot of people who are associated with the Christian right probably don't even really realize Rush Dooney's influence on the movement. There would be a lot of people who probably wouldn't know Rush Dooney's name, yet a lot of his ideas have been suffused throughout the movement and are very important to the ideology, even if people haven't read his very dense books.
Yeah, it's not easy reading.
His very dense theology, which is, you know, it's not easy reading at all.
It's not easy.
Much more influential are the, you know, the kind of the televangelists that I talk a lot about in the book.
Going through the book, you say that during the Trump candidacy, going back to 2015, 2016, the racism, the nativism, the xenophobia, this whole thing about political correctness, we're going to say Merry Christmas again and all that, and the Islamophobia. These things were not by accident. They were actually by design. And to me, what's fascinating about what you're doing in the book is you say, I think, if I get this right, it then appealed to both of those bases, the Christian right and the alt-right, all those things. And you said, I think somewhere that maybe the cruelty is the point. And you think, man, a lot of people have tried to figure out why Christians have embraced Trump against everything that they claim to stand for. And yet,
well,
you lay out the architecture of the whole thing.
I can't take credit for the cruelty is the point phrase.
Right. That wasn't you.
That was not my phrase, yeah. But Trump's opening salvo in his campaign, the Mexicans are rapists and criminals who are coming to ruin our country.
Some are good people, I assume.
Right. You know, the Islamophobia, the racism, his, you know, calls at his campaign rallies for Black Lives Matter protesters to be roughed up. You know, this was happening during his primary campaign. And he was definitely electrifying the alt-right at the time. I mean, immediately. And there were a lot of leading figures in the alt-right, you know, white supremacists, you know, anti-immigrant activists, neo-Nazis even, who were very excited about Trump's candidacy. And I think that there were a lot of leadership figures in the Christian right who were skeptical. One reason was, obviously, he did not really fit their criteria of being a Christian and a good family man.
Being generous,
I think also the Christian, and I think that also they had spent recent years trying to present themselves as more of a big tent kind of movement, and the Republican Party was trying to present itself as more of a big tent kind of party. Mm-hmm. They saw the demographic writing on the wall and thought that they needed to seem more welcoming to minorities, African Americans, Latinos. And so I think there was like a bit of discomfort that like, oh, we've been trying to do that. And like, he's, you know, not really fitting that mold. Mm-hmm. But what they saw was the bass was really excited about him. And yeah. So he was really speaking to this idea that America, as you know it, Christian America, as you know it, is being taken away from you, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the through lines of the book is that both the alt-right and the Christian right really are opposed to what we would think of as a liberal democracy, where everyone's civil rights are protected. Both of these movements see that as a threat to them. You know, in the case of the alt-right, they see it as a threat to white America. The Christian mm-hmm. right, Christian America, although it's really white Christian America.
Exactly.
And so he ended up appealing to both of these bases, and the leadership ended up coming around to him in some cases, I think probably because it was obvious that there was going to be no other alternative, that no one else in that field of 17 presidential candidates could beat him in the primary.
Mm-hmm.
And then he made a bunch of convenient promises to the leadership, and then they started backing him. And now they back him even more enthusiastically than they did in the middle of 2016. Mm-hmm. So if you think back 4 years ago, the Republican National Convention had pretty much just concluded, and there were still a lot of questions about whether the Christian right base would turn out for him. And they did. And the leadership has been spending the past 4 years building him up.
Yeah.
Building up the base's enthusiasm for him. And I think they didn't anticipate that we would have a pandemic.
Nobody
but,
did.
But, you know, he is counting on their support. I mean, without their support, it would be very difficult for him to win re-election.
It would be. And there's all these articles constantly coming out that his base is slipping, his evangelical base is cracking. But I don't believe it. I'm very skeptical when it comes to that kind of reporting. It seems like there's always a rock solid 79-81% of white evangelicals. They are going nowhere. But he's not adding to that base. That's what's so fascinating, is he? He really isn't adding. It's that sort of middle group that may be undecided. I think that's the one we have to worry about in 2020, this election coming up.
In terms of his white evangelical base, throughout his, you know, since he got the nomination in 2016, his approval with that base has fluctuated from the low to mid 60s to the high 70s, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think there are a lot of people who might see a poll that finds his support in the 60s as opposed to the 70s with this group, and pointing at that and saying, oh, look, you know, his support is slipping. But that's been sort of a normal fluctuation throughout his first presidential campaign and presidency. And I always think back to September of 2016, when the polling was showing that he was getting about a 65-ish percent approval rating from white evangelicals. And everybody knew that that was too low for him to win, right? And then it was even after the Access Hollywood tape that that shot up to, you know, 81%. That's the percentage of white evangelicals who voted for him. So I'm very skeptical of stories about the evangelical base cracking. And I think there was one poll recently that showed that, well, only about 60-something percent of white evangelicals approved of his handling of the pandemic. 82% of them still planned on voting for him. Mm. So I think that for other people might think, well, his response to the pandemic has been an utter catastrophe. So how could you vote for him? Yeah. But you have to be inside the mindset of his Christian right base to realize that that is not the most important thing to them. The most important thing to them is, are they going to lose control of government agencies? Are they going to lose the ability to have a say in the nomination of judges and the continued erosion of the separation of church and state, the continued elevation of their religious rights over other mm-hmm. people's rights? And that's what they're looking at. So while white evangelicals are the most homogenous part of his base, you know, they're in coalition with conservative white Catholics and conservative white mainland Protestants. So, you know, it's a bigger base than that, but that's kind of the core mm-hmm. and the most reliable part of it for him.
And that is one of the biggest reasons why I think, as you say, so many continue to support him. This issue of religious freedom, religious liberty. I was going to ask you about that because there's a connection, isn't there? There's a narrative out there in much of evangelicalism that our religious liberty is being denied us and certainly was attacked during the 8 years of Obama. But now Trump is standing up. He's the strong man. He's the Cyrus. Mm-hmm. He's the King David, right, whatever figure you want. But at the same time, they're actually denying the freedoms and liberties to minorities, people of color, LGBTQ people, and even going further than that, discriminating against them on the grounds of religious conscience, quote unquote. But Trump is the strong man. He's fighting for those religious freedoms. So surely that's got to be one of the main planks in their support.
That is the main pitch that mm-hmm. religious right leaders are making to the base in support of Trump's reelection campaign. They mm-hmm. talk about it constantly. And they talk about him being the most pro-religious freedom president in history. He's just held up as this savior, really, of Christian America, where other leaders have failed. And I think it's important to continue to emphasize the through line of my book, right? Mm-hmm. Which is that his strongman propensities and his disdain for the institutions and values of a liberal democracy are features, not bugs, to his base. Right. And that's what the Christian right and the alt-right have in common, right? It's that they don't really like a liberal democracy. They'd rather have a strong man who defends what they see as their heritage against the incursions of minorities and others and immigrants and LGBTQ mm-hmm. people who've ruined what was, in their view, white America or Christian America. Mm-hmm.
We will be right back in just a minute with the second half of my conversation with Sarah Posner as we continue talking about her new book, Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. And as I said to Sarah, what was so surprising as I worked my way through her book was how she goes into really great detail showing how it's not just the white evangelical base, it's also the alt-right, and that these things that Trump has been saying since he was a candidate are no accident. They were by design to appeal actually to both sides. And this is what really has formed Trump's base. And this is something that should be a major concern to all of us moving forward. And I would say too, if you're an evangelical Christian who is listening to this episode, you need to think about the sort of racist roots of the Christian right. If you're a part of that, you're actually part of the system, whether or not you believe it or not. You are helping to prop up the system by giving money to it, or at least to a church. So this is something to be concerned about for sure. And as I've said many times before, Trumpism will not go away, even though Trump may leave office, whether it's in November 2020 or another 4 years. But the fact remains that Trumpism is not going away at all anytime soon. So these are things that Americans and indeed the rest of the world we have to wrestle with and resist, because as we're seeing, there is an increasing move toward the far right, not just in America, but in places all over the world, other countries and other dictators who are really becoming far-right strongmen. So this is a real serious issue that we have to deal with. And I'm glad for people like Sarah Posner and others that I've been talking to lately who have been doing a tremendous amount of work on this. And in fact, speaking of people who have done a tremendous amount of work, I'm going to be speaking in the next episode of Mindshift Podcast with Dr. Warren Throckmorton. Not only has he written many, many articles, but he's also actually co-written a book with Michael Coulter debunking the so-called historian David Barton. He's probably the one who is the most well-known in terms of being a Christian nationalist, promoting the myth of America as a Christian nation. He's a darling of the evangelical world, the Christian right. And so look for the chat with Dr. Warren Throckmorton coming up. And then after that, as I mentioned, I've also got Dr. Michael McVicker, who wrote a fantastic book on R.J. Rush Dooney. We mentioned him a little bit in this chat with Sarah, but we go into great depth talking about his life's history and the impact that he had on the Christian right, Christian homeschooling, and many other things. And as Sarah said, a lot of people wouldn't know the name Rush Dooney, but I've been doing a lot of work on him, doing a lot of research and writing, so I thoroughly enjoyed talking with Dr. Michael McVicker, and I think you'll enjoy that conversation as well. I've also got a chat coming up with Paul Kibble as we talk about his book on Christian hegemony, so those are the next three episodes that are slated to drop here on Mindshift Podcast over the next several weeks. And one last thing, you can also follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. If you have any thoughts, comments, questions, you can also get a hold of Sarah at Sarah Posner on Twitter as well. All right, now that we got the business out of the way, let's get back into the chat with Sarah as we continue to talk about her book, Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. That's one of the things I really thought was good about the book. As you say, you make that point that actually it's not even just an American thing now. It's a worldwide thing. We're seeing it in Europe and South America, where this global liberalism is sort of this enemy, because it's, as you say, it's anti-family. That is traditional families, one man, one woman, and all that. You've got LGBTQ rights and all these other things wrapped up in this, quote, pro-family sort of narrative, which, of course, look at all the big organizations focus on the Family Research Council, the family leader. You know, these organizations, it's all going back to that traditional definition of the family. And then if he's going to support those rights, happy days, then that seems like that's kind of their view.
I think that it's not just that he supports it. It's that he is unbowed by what they would call political correctness and what other people would call accountability, oversight, common human decency of protecting the rights and dignity of all people.
Yeah, there is that.
So I think it's not just that he says the right things, because I think a lot of the time he doesn't even have the words to say the right things. It's really more about this disdain he has for liberalism, or what they might call political correctness. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is a big reason why he's so appealing to his base, because they believe that even other Republican presidents have kind of pussyfooted around all of that, right? Mm-hmm. And been too concerned about their place in history or bipartisanship or civility even. Mm. And so I think that that to me is really, like I said, it's a feature, not a bug.
Exactly. That's the concern, isn't it? What about some of these key players on the alt-right? You're saying the middle of the book really focuses on the alt-right. The name Richard Spencer comes up a lot. So I did a bit of reading on this guy. I mean, I've heard of him before. The guy, he's a neo-Nazi. He's a conspiracy theorist. He's anti-Semitic. He's a white supremacist leader. You know, he's appeared at the Charlottesville rally and other neo-Nazi rallies. This guy is a rabid Trump supporter. Why is a guy like Richard Spencer, or is he a Trump supporter?
Well, he was.
Oh, he was.
He was during the campaign, right? Ah. And so when I was talking about earlier how Trump's campaign electrified the alt-right, people like Spencer really thought that Trump was speaking to the issues of what they call white dispossession. So they mm-hmm. believe that white people are being dispossessed in their own country of America, and that Trump talking about immigration and using this nativist language and using racist language and proposing racist and nativist policies was going to save them from that white dispossession. Now, after Trump became president, Spencer, I've interviewed him a number of times. Mm-hmm. He's a big admirer and actually personally knows Stephen Miller and is in favor of those things. But I think he ultimately soured on Trump, I think, because Trump, I think, became kind of too buffoonish for him.
Right.
But I think that Trump still has a lot of support otherwise on the alt-right, certainly a lot of support for his immigration policies. And I think to the extent that he's pushing back on and demonizing the Black Lives Matter protests mm-hmm. and pushing this idea that we need to save the heritage by not, you know, bringing down statues and that sort of thing. All of that is the sort of thing that would appeal to the alt-right. The other thing I think that is important to understand about the alt-right is they too, although in different ways, are playing a long game like the Christian right mm-hmm. is. The alt-right is less interested and involved in the nuts and bolts of political campaigns and more interested in ideas and ideology and changing and shifting people's ideas and ideology over time. So they're mm-hmm. also playing a long game, but in a different way.
And there's this element of conspiracy theories. That's something that fuels both of those bases. One of the things that struck me was, I think the final chapter of your book, you kind of spent some time talking about how the Christian right, for sure, uses conspiracy theories, first of all, in their defense of Trump, but also in their sort of continuing support for him. It was fascinating because I don't know if you came across, there was an article just a couple of days ago in Salon by Amanda Marcotte, and she was talking about how conspiracy theories have played into real world violence. If you're that angry about what they're doing to my president, you're going to do something about it. I mean, the most obvious example, Caesar Sayoc. Here's a guy who got so angry about these critics of Trump, these Democrats, he mails 16 pipe bombs to these people, Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. So what's the role of conspiracy theories in all this? Because you got the echo chamber, don't you? Fox News, Breitbart, Alex Jones, Rush Limbaugh, and of course, Trump himself. It's all this echo chamber.
Yeah, I mean, both the Christian right and the alt-right subscribe to many of the same conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. The main ones being that there's a deep state that's out to get Trump, and the other being that George Soros is this global bogeyman who is promoting leftist ideology, or what the Christian right might call gender ideology, which is a catchphrase they use to encompass LGBTQ rights and reproductive rights. Mm-hmm. And conspiracy theories play a very key role in both movements because, well, I mean, there's lots of reasons why conspiracy theories play a role, but both do use conspiracy theories to demonize political enemies and portray Trump as being a victim, really, of these insidious
deep state
forces that are conspiring to undermine him. Very similar to the conspiracy theories that underline the QAnon conspiracy theory. Right. There's sort of a lot of shared threads here. Mm-hmm. That there's a deep state that protects Hillary Clinton and pedophiles
Pizzagate,
trying to take down Donald Trump, right?
Even the coronavirus is somehow a big hoax. Maybe Bill Clinton or Bill Gates is involved.
Right.
He wants to inject a vaccine with a chip in it to track you. And
yes,
on and on it goes. It's just,
talk about rabbit holes, right?
Oh, man. But it's all over the place because, I mean, I'm seeing on Facebook, you see it. I mean, Facebook and social media has just become a battleground for different ideologies, isn't it? But I've seen several posts recently where certain of my friends have just come out and said, look, these Black Lives Matters, that's nothing but a front for terrorism, and they're murdering people, they're dragging them out of cars, and it's all, Trump's doing the right thing by sending in these troops to places like Portland, and any kind of pushback is fake news. You think, well, no, I've got friends who live in Portland who are down there, and that's not the way it is. Nope, fake news. So you can't even have a conversation about any of this stuff. It's all fake news.
Yep.
Well, now there's another aspect to this whole thing we haven't talked about, and that is the case of Donald Trump's relationship with Vladimir Putin. That's a whole nother thing, but it somehow figures into this because you spend some time in the book talking about that. Okay, he's got a very sort of toadying, sort of sycophantic relationship with Putin, which is very strange. It seemed like nobody really knows what Putin has on Trump. But what surprised me was you talk about in the book, well before the Trump-Putin thing, Christian right leaders were holding up Putin and other far-right dictators, basically, as examples from which Americans could learn. So it seems like there was these overtures going on way before the Trump-Putin thing.
I don't want to suggest that there was some conspiracy or plot to bring Trump with Putin.
Sure.
I think this is part of a global far-right movement that is drawing on these sort of proto-fascist ideas around what is a family and what is a nation's heritage and what is a nation's, in particular, religious heritage, or in this case, Christian heritage. And so, Trump comes along at a time when you're seeing the rise of autocratic nationalists like Vladimir Putin and like Viktor Orban in Hungary and others in other countries. And so this is happening at a time when the Christian right has been looking at these leaders as strong men to admire because they're pushing back on this idea of like gender ideology or liberal ideas that George Soros is promoting. And that's all just basically code for, we don't like liberal democracy. We don't like the strong leader to be accountable by the legislature or by the courts. His attacks on a free press are okay with us. And in particular, we like the idea that somebody like Orban or Putin would talk in these sort of very glowing terms about the country's Christian heritage, mm-hmm. and that they would crack down on LGBTQ rights or scale back women's rights or reproductive rights. So it's all part of this package and this global erosion of liberal democracy and liberal democratic ideals. It's all kind of happening at the same time, and obviously it all feeds mm-hmm. off of each other. But yes, it wasn't just, the Christian right didn't just suddenly say, oh, we're okay with Putin because Trump's okay with Putin. Right. They were already okay with Putin.
Right. That's what I found fascinating about, you know, talking about Paul Weyrich, for example. He's pointing to Putin years before Trump ever was on the scene, saying essentially what you said, that, look, Putin, yeah, some things about his personal life and the way he treats, you know, people, they're kind of objectionable, but he's very strong on the family, the traditional family. He's anti-LGBTQ. Okay, so he invaded Ukraine and Crimea. We can overlook those. And you hear that same rhetoric around the Trump candidacy and the Trump presidency, don't you? I mean, I remember listening to David Barton just the other day. He was on Kenneth Copeland's Believer's Voice of Victory. And he said, well, you know, I don't like Trump's tweets and some things he does are kind of, you know, problematic. But he's putting us in a position where God can bless America. So that's what we really need to focus on. There you have it right there. You can overlook the character flaws and all the rest of it as long as he's delivering. So Barton's okay with it.
Right. And that's a really common refrain sure. among Christian right activists. Heard it 1,000,000,000,000 times before. Mm-hmm. And layered onto that is the argument that sometimes God chooses an unlikely leader to carry out his purposes.
Yeah, Cyrus.
So to convince people that Trump is actually has God's hand on him and is carrying out God's purposes. That's a very strong argument. And you, if you layer onto that, well, the only people who are trying to bring Trump down are, you know, the deep state, Hillary Clinton's allies, George yeah. Soros,
the lame whoever, media. Whoever,
right. The fake yeah. news, right?
Fake news.
And so then people really start to believe, you know, the combination of the conspiracy theory and the God's will combines in their mind to believe that, you know, this is God's man, and only who would come against God's chosen one? Only somebody terrible.
Mm-hmm. To go against Trump is essentially going against God. I think right. it was Lance Wallnau who said something like that. In effect, if you're against Trump, you're against God. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty big statement for someone who thinks they're a Christian. You go, wow, that's yeah. a strong statement. I was going to say, there's a couple last questions. Now, in the book, you note one thing that struck me. You said, in terms of the Christian right, their vision for America, there's two trends that are developing. One is this sort of authoritarian, autocratic trend. And then the other one is theocracy. Do you see that as happening now? In terms of Christian nationalism and all the things that are going on, where do you see those two trends playing out?
Well, they're kind of the same, right? So Christian mm-hmm. nationalism is the idea that America was founded as a Christian nation and should be governed as a Christian nation, right? And so when you hear them talking about wanting candidates who would govern from a biblical worldview or a Christian worldview, that's mm-hmm. a Christian nationalist idea that would help carry out a theocracy, right? So like if you're having government officials make policy based on what they believe is a biblical point of view, mm-hmm. that's a theocracy. So if you say, you know, Betsy DeVos at the Department of Education, Trump issues an executive order to make it easier for there to be official school prayer in public schools, or to provide taxpayer-funded vouchers for mm-hmm. private religious schools, or at the Department of Health and Human Services, where faith-based organizations that receive taxpayer money are given these huge religious exemptions to discriminate against people based on religion or their sexual orientation or gender identity. The Supreme Court, it has been for years chipping away at the legal principles underlying the separation of church and state. And it's the Christian right's intention to continue to do that and hopefully nominate justices who would carry that to its logical conclusion.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's their stated goal. It's not like they're being
it's no secret
cagey about it, right? Like, yeah. This is what they've been talking about for 40 years.
Mm. And they found someone who's getting it done. That's right. The thing about it. You go back to that open letter to Mark Galley in Christianity Today. I don't know if you remember that. Caused a bit of a firestorm a couple years ago, where he was one of the first kind of leading evangelicals to speak out and say, you know, we should be ashamed of ourselves for supporting Trump. And there was that open letter signed by some, I think it was around 200 key sort of dominionist figures, Christian right leaders, guys like Tony Perkins and other people like that. And I found that absolutely fascinating because they said,
I can't remember what their letter was in response to. The Mark Galley thing was he wrote the editorial in Christianity Today saying that Trump should be impeached. That was back in late 2019.
Yeah.
So was the letter that you're talking about also in response to something that Galley wrote?
It was in response to it was an open letter response to the article. So they basically said, hey, don't paint us with this broad brush. We're not theocrats. Right. Yeah. But then they say, we support Trump because he's appointed judges and he's doing all these, he's delivering.
Right.
And so, you know, that's why we're behind him. So how dare you impugn us? And what I did, I went through it because I was doing all this research on dominion theology and Christian Reconstructionism. I immediately recognized a whole bunch of the names, the signers of the letter. So I started researching and writing about that, which I found another rabbit hole that you go down. Because there's apostolic ministries, POTUS Shield, on and on and on you go. And it's like, my God, where does this thing end? It's another rabbit hole. So there's one last question then. In your opinion, what's the goal? What's the end game, though, for the Christian right? Because you could plug in a guy like Rush Dooney. Okay. He wanted limited government and like a Handmaid's Tale, almost kind of a vision. Is that what you see going forward for the Christian right? Where are they taking this thing?
I think that culturally, they know that they've lost many of the culture wars. I mean, they've lost the battle, culturally speaking, over LGBTQ rights, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, same-sex marriage is legal across the country. So they're approaching that in the same way, in a similar way to that they approached Roe v. Wade. Maybe we can't get that decision overturned right away, but we're going to chip away at it. And their way of chipping away at same-sex marriage is to claim that they should have religious exemptions when dealing with LGBTQ people, right? Mm. So it's like, I am a wedding photographer, and I think that marriage is between, my religious belief is that marriage is between a man and a woman. And so therefore, I shouldn't have to comply with local non-discrimination laws that make it illegal for me to turn a same-sex couple away because of my religious belief. So it's those sorts of efforts to create basically a huge hole in non-discrimination laws so that these Christians who oppose abortion or contraception or LGBTQ rights basically operate in a different legal environment.
Mm-hmm.
But that's never how religious exemptions have been used, right? But if you continue to be able to have like-minded judges nominated to the courts and have like-minded political appointees running the government, you can put all of those things in place. Mm. And so that is why they're so intent on getting Trump reelected, because they know that they could, like, this could be a very lost opportunity for them because of the cultural shifts and public opinion. You know, they're out of step with public opinion, but they're hoping that they can carve out this special place for themselves within the law.
And what makes it fascinating too, and I guess dangerous, is that the Christian right, the evangelical right, they've got these huge legal powerhouses like the Alliance Defending Freedom and other organizations, ACLJ, J Seculo, people like that.
Right.
They have got unbelievable amounts of money to fight these cases all the way to the Supreme Court. So if you're the Masterpiece Cake Shop or something like that, as you say, the wedding photographer, they'll represent you for free, pro bono, all the way to the top if they have to. Whereas most people, the atheist doesn't have, well, I guess you might have the ACLU. They might come to bat for you, but they don't have the deep pockets that the ADF and some of these other organizations do.
They have very deep pockets and also a willingness to continue to press what are thought of as being kind of fringe legal theories and making them mainstream, right? Mm-hmm. So when you think about like the Hobby Lobby case where the Supreme Court ruled that a company mm-hmm. had religious rights to refuse to provide contraception coverage in their employer health plan, that was considered, you know, as they were building that case, most legal scholars thought it had no chance, right? But because ADF and the Beckett Fund and Liberty Council and ACLJ, as you say, they're willing to press these and press these and press these cases, even if the legal theory seems like it won't make it. That's part of why they succeed, because of that kind of persistence. Mm-hmm.
And they've got the funding as well, don't they? And there's the
resources,
another piece.
And the persistence. Yeah.
Yeah. The dark funding and all that. I know Catherine Stewart, in her works, she's done a lot of work on tracing some of the dark money that comes from people like the Green family and the DeVos family.
I wouldn't call it dark money, though, because, I mean, ADF is a nonprofit. And so for many very good reasons, the contributions of the tax-exempt contributions of donors to nonprofit organizations have never been discoverable. And the reason for that is the Supreme Court held in a case that involved, I think, the NAACP, was so that, you know, people wouldn't be demonized or investigated by the government for their donations to charitable organizations. So I wouldn't really call that dark money because that's just the law.
Yeah, it's just money.
Yeah, it's just money. But I mean, I think that, you know, dark money is more, you know, in politics where we do have a system of disclosure, or used to have a system of disclosure of donors, right? But those are two very different things. So yes, the ADF does have a lot of money, and a lot of it comes from big, wealthy foundations that give them money. And that is public record. But yeah, it's, you know, I mean, it's not like they're illegitimately raising money. It's people give it to them voluntarily.
Exactly. But we don't have the funding like the families like the DeVos family, the Green family, and some of these other people. You know, we're trying to get the word out, which I thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed reading your book. And as I say, I was really kind of, I guess, gobsmacked a little bit by the whole Christian right, alt-right thing. So thank you so much for what you're doing. How can people find you? That's my other question. Where are you on social media?
So they can find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Sarah Posner. Sarah has an H. And my website, sarahposner.com.
Well, thank you, Sarah Posner. I loved your book. I really appreciate it. I'm going to go now listen to God's Prophets. That's the next book on the list. So I may be trying to tap you up again if you're willing to talk to me another time.
Sure. I don't think there's an audiobook for God's Prophets.
But. Oh, no. I might actually have to read a book.
Yes, exactly.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm sure I will hopefully be speaking to you again. If you're up to chatting again, I would love to talk to you another time.
Happy to do it. Thank you.